Welcome, everyone. I'm Robbie Watkins. On behalf of Geshe Gelick and the members of Kadampa Center, I'd like to welcome everyone to this very special event, quite unexpected special event, and it's really a real thrill for all of us. People may not realize that the full name of Kadampa Center is Kadampa Center for the Practice of Tibetan Buddhism in the Gelupa Tradition. So our full name right off the bat tells us that Kadampa Center has a connection with Tibet. And Tibet, both culturally and sociologically over the centuries, provided a perfect environment for the teachings of the Buddha to survive. So all of us who have benefited from those teachings have an enormous sense of gratitude and concern for the people of Tibet. In addition, as a member organization of the FPMT, the Worldwide Group of Buddhist Centers, under the guidance of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, we have another special connection with His Holiness. Lama Zopa Rinpoche is a tremendously dedicated student of His Holiness, and he's always asking His Holiness to pray for the success of the FPMT Center. So that's something we can be very thankful for. Our honorable guest this evening is Mr. Lobsang Nyondak. Is that pronounced? Okay. Lobsang Nyondak? Okay. Who, official position is a representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama to the Americas. This is a position that he has held since 2008. Prior to that, he was a cabinet member of the Central Tibetan Administration in Dharamsala, where he was responsible for the Department of Information and International Relations, the Department of Finance, and the Department of Health. So it's a very great honor to have him here, and we welcome you. And we look forward to hearing from you talk about the situation of the Tibetan people.
I just wanted to say thank you. That's all. Hello, hello.
Oh, okay.
So I understand that the format would be I'll speak for about 20-30 minutes, and then, you know, we'll have a Q&A session, and definitely I would prefer to have more of informal discussion rather than giving a formal talk. First of all, let me sincerely thank Geshe Gelela and Geshe Sambula for providing me this opportunity to share my thoughts, and in fact, this is my first visit to North Carolina. I have been in the past, I think since I took over as His Holiness representative in 2008, I have somehow gotten to know North Carolina since then, particularly because His Holiness was scheduled to visit North Carolina, and I received a confirmation letter from the private office in India stating that I should reach out to the potential host of His Holiness' visit here in North Carolina. But when I did that, I found out that the original host, who extended the invitation to His Holiness was no longer there. You know, so then all of a sudden there was no one who was, you know, going to host His Holiness. That was obviously very unfortunate. And then later, you know, there has been strong kind of interest being expressed by several learning institutions here, including our Kadamba Center here. So I just spoke with Gishi Gerela, you know, this evening when we were having dinner together, that His Holiness will definitely look forward to visit North Carolina, most probably in October of 2014. And, you know, we will, you know, Gishla and we will, you know, and Gishla and we will walk, you know, together to make sure that there will be a visit, because I have a tentative time slot for North Carolina. It's for a very short duration. As you know, His Holiness really travels around the world a lot, and he doesn't have much time to stay in one particular city for long. So, but nevertheless, there is very high hopes that His Holiness will be here 2014. Obviously, you know, I normally when I give some, you know, presentation, I first of all, you know, always thank my audience. Primarily because I always believe that, you know, you are here not because you want to listen to me, but, you know, just because you care about Tibetan people. You know, it's because, you know, you are concerned about the plight of the Tibetan people. And this is in some way an expression of your solidarity to the Tibetan people. And perhaps, you know, many of you have become a part of Tibetan society through, you know, our culture and our religion. And therefore, you know, maybe it's kind of obligatory that, you know, you be there when there's a Tibetan event taking place in your city. Obviously, His Holiness, you know, many a times, you know, he defines you know, Tibetan culture as a Buddhist culture. You know, Tibetan culture is essentially a Buddhist culture. And Buddhist culture is nothing but it's a culture of compassion, culture of peace, culture of nonviolence. And, but unfortunately, you know, this compassionate culture is being perceived as a threat by the Chinese Communist authorities, because they see this as a threat against their, you know, rule over Tibet, and maybe, you know, their legitimacy in controlling Tibet. And therefore, no matter, you know, who rules China, since People's Republic of China was established in 1949. All the successive Chinese rulers or, you know, or government in Beijing has been holding a policy of very suppressive, you know, in particularly the Buddhist institutions. And as you know, prior to the invasion of Tibet, we used to boast of having over 6,200 monastic institutions throughout Tibet. We used to boast of having more than 600,000 monks and nuns. But then before and during the Cultural Revolution, you know, that shook almost all over China, including Tibet, all the monastic institutions were razed to ground except for 13. And we have had no monks and nuns at the time. Either many were, you know, arrested, imprisoned, died, or disrobed forcibly. And then, obviously, you know, time has changed. Since 1979, there has been so-called liberalization policies under Deng Xiaoping. You know, Tibetans were allowed to rebuild their monasteries and temples. And now the Chinese authorities estimate the number of monastic institutions in Tibet is, I think, a little over 1700, I believe. Interestingly, even though all these monastic institutions are being now allowed to carry out their religious activities, but somehow the successive Chinese governments have been what they called, the Strike Hard campaign. They have launched this Strike Hard campaign or the patriotic re-education campaign since 1996. And they have mentioned it officially that there has been no monks or nuns left in these over 1700 monastic institutions where they haven't, undertaken Strike Hard campaign or the re-education of monks and nuns. So what exactly they do in re-educating the Tibetan, clergies? What they say is that teach Tibetan monks and nuns of socialist values. But actually, what they do is they force Tibetans, monks and nuns to denounce his house of Dalai Lama, their own spiritual leader. They are asked to denounce who advocates independence of Tibet. They are asked to recognize the Panchen Lama that is recognized by the Chinese government. Though these are some kind of, political issues that the monks and nuns are forced to take pledge on. So therefore, as you see, over the last over 50 years, Tibetans' resentments have been growing and ever increasing. And this has been shown by, self-immolations that have almost shook the entire Tibetan areas. The latest one occurred just 2 days ago by a young monk, 18-year-old monk, Kunjo Sonam, from Ngaba, Amdo Ngaba. He set himself on fire simply to express his ultimate resentment against the Chinese authorities of their repressive policies. And with this self-immolation, now 121 Tibetans have set themselves on fire, and over 105 of them have, died. But the Chinese authorities refuse to, acknowledge that the root cause of self-immolation is their own misrule over Tibet. They continue to believe that Tibetans are extremely heavy under, Chinese rule. In March of this year, in one Chinese media, it covered that they have recently conducted a survey in many cities in China, and they have found out that the people in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, are the happiest people in overall China, ironically. When I heard that, it was almost a day after I was meeting one, Chinese from Beijing. So I told them, such a report has been, reported in one of the Chinese media. And I told them if, the Chinese leaders and Chinese authorities continue to fool themselves with this kind of information, that's not really going to help them. I gave them an example also. In late 1970s, before the first Tibetan delegation were allowed to visit Tibetan areas after the so-called liberalization that took place in Tibet after 1979, the Chinese authorities in Tibetan areas have been advising the Tibetan people at that time that if the Dalai Lama representatives from exile, come to our place, you are not allowed to throw stones at them. You are not allowed to spit on them. You are not allowed to protest, when they visit our place. Perhaps maybe the Chinese leaders at the time, you know, believed that the Tibetan people inside Tibet, you know, feel so grateful to the communist China that when the Dalai Lama's representatives come, that they will have lots of hatred and, you know, resentments against them. But when actually the Dalai Lama's representative came to Tibetan areas, Chinese, you know, leaders were kind of, you know, totally taken aback by the emotional response, you know, outbursts of emotions of the Tibetan people for their love and respect. So still the Chinese government refused to kind of, you know, learn from past experiences. They continue to believe that Tibetans are very thankful to the communist leaders. Tibetans are still very, you know, happy in Tibet. So the real answer is, or the question to the Chinese authorities is, then why so many Tibetans are setting themselves on fire? Why thousands of Tibetans continue to escape over the high Himalayas during the peak winter, risking their lives? And amongst them, there are hundreds of young children who are also escaping. In recent years, we have also conducted a survey amongst those Tibetan children who escaped from Tibet to understand, you know, how well they are knowledgeable in their own language. And of the 50 children interviewed, only 2 can read and write in Tibetan language. All others, the 48 of them, could only speak and understand in Chinese language. And there are Tibetan scholars who have written articles expressing their strong view that the Tibetan language is rather confined to college campus. Now, when you leave the college, Tibetan language is almost not in use in our society. And in recent years also, one Western tourist, you know, when she returned from Tibet, she had 3, you know, papers with her. One, a hospital bill, and the second one is the postal's, you know, bill, and third one I really don't remember. But what she said was, for instance, if you go to a hospital, all the forms that are to be filled are in Chinese language, and if you go to a postal office, similarly, everything has to be filled in Chinese. And if you go to a grocery shop, all the, you know, labels on the items, products, are all in Chinese. So Tibetans who cannot speak Chinese language can be very hard for them to survive in our own country. So this is the situation in terms of, you know, Chinese sinicization policies, which has affected the very Tibetan language, Tibetan culture, and the Tibetan religion. So, under these circumstances, obviously, yes, we are having lots of difficulties. But at the same time, we have many reasons to be optimistic. You know, His Holiness is our supreme leader, even though he devolved his all political authorities. He decided to devolve his temporal position that has been established since the 5th Dalai Lama, from 1642. You know, the 14th Dalai Lama has ended the rule of the Dalai Lama, which has been there since, I think, almost 370 years back. But nevertheless, even though he does not have the political authorities, but, you know, Tibetans continue to believe him as the supreme leader of the Tibetan people, both inside and outside Tibet. We all believe that he is the leader who could help alleviate the sufferings of the Tibetan people. He is the leader who could help resolve the long-standing political issue of the Tibetan people. And, you know, one Chinese, again from Beijing, told me once that Tibetan has lots of potential, in fact, in terms of, you know, resolving the issue of Tibet. He believes that we have two very strong assets. The one is the charismatic leadership of the Dalai Lama, and second is the democratic system that is existing in the exiled Tibetan community. Because this democracy, you know, since 2011, as I said, His Holiness has devolved his political authorities, we have elected democratically our own political leader. So this democracy legitimizes the Tibetan freedom struggle. And therefore, you know, this is seen as, again, as a challenge from Chinese perspective in terms of, you know, when they say that His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the exiled Tibetan leaders have no say in controlling the, you know, the affairs of the Tibetan people, but on the contrary, we always say that Tibetan people have not given the mandate for the Chinese leaders to rule Tibet. They are the ones who have controlled us without our consent. So on the contrary, we are here, Tibetan people are electing our own political leadership with, you know, and therefore this further helps us legitimize the, you know, the struggle movement of the Tibetan people. So, again, I would say, even though it's a very sad situation that the, you know, so many Tibetans are setting themselves on fire, but there are many, you know, people who are confused with this kind of, you know, protests by the Tibetan people. We have met many different kinds of people. You know, we have been raised number of questions, even by young students when we, you know, go and talk to different, you know, students in different colleges. You know, there were sometimes in tears, you know, students ask questions about why can't you lead them in organizing different form of protest rather than sacrificing their own life in such a horrific manner. And there are people around the world, even the Chinese people, who do not or cannot rather accept this kind of drastic, you know, actions of the Tibetan people. But if you really kind of, you know, understand the situation in Tibet, it's not that the Tibetan people have not attempted other non-violent methods to express their resentments against the Chinese authorities. Over the past, you know, 5 decades, Tibetans inside Tibet have attempted lots and lots of street protests, hunger strikes inside prisons. But the ultimate, you know, result is the Chinese authorities either shoot them on sight, or they're arrested and imprisoned and tortured to death. And there's no other options left for the Tibetan people inside Tibet to express. And there's one expert who had studied different forms of protest, and he stated that the self-immolations take place in a society where there is no other form of communication. In a democratic society, can you imagine a person self-immolating just to protest against their government of their wrong policies? In the United States, I was told that there were two or three self-immolations, you know, took place in mid-60s in front of, I think, Pentagon. That was all from immigrant protesting against the Vietnam War rather than to do with the, you know, U.S. government policies or the U.S. leaders, you know, policies. But in Tibet, as I mentioned, that we have no other forms of communication to the Chinese authorities except to resort to this kind of, you know, action, which obviously is very painful, not only to the individual, you know, but to His Holiness and to the Tibetan people. So, however, this also shows the strong determination and the will of the Tibetan people to convey to the Chinese authorities that, you know, no matter what, we have no fears even to give up our own lives. So this determination is another, you know, form of asset for the Tibetan people to, you know, believe that no matter how hard the Chinese government, you know, would be, the spirit of Tibetan people will never die, even if it means another 5 decades. In, I think, recent weeks, maybe sometime starting from mid-June, we have had some kind of positive news coming from some Tibetan areas. That was very positive when we first heard about it, particularly from Chong'an in Amdo and some parts of Tibetan areas, including central Tibet. In some of the local meetings, public meetings, Tibetans were informed that now you are allowed to worship the Dalai Lama as a spiritual leader. But obviously you have to separate politics and religion. And that in some meetings, Tibetans were also told that you are allowed to recognize His Holiness as a spiritual leader, but not a political leader. And during the same time, there was one Chinese professor from Central Party School in Beijing who gave a long interview advising the communist leaders that they should not consider His Holiness as the enemy of China. If they do it, that would further alienate the Tibetan people and that they will not be able to win the hearts and minds of the Tibetan people. So all this, you know, development, we felt that there is a positive ground changes taking place in Tibet. But when this news started coming out in the media, the Chinese government, you know, refused to acknowledge that this is true. And then soon after, maybe, you know, 2 weeks ago, we have again learned that the Chinese government has started to be to have the hardline policy against the Tibetan people and also against His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So presently, you know, the situation has kind of continued to worsen. As I said, one of the main reasons why Tibetans, people inside Tibet, especially in monastic institutions, the unhappiness, the resentments, the hatred against the Chinese government is simply because every day the so-called Starcard campaign or the work teams, you know, which are stationed in all major monastic institutions, forcing Tibetan monks and nuns to denounce His Holiness. So this kind of thing, which continues, is increasing the, you know, resentments against the Chinese authorities. And unfortunately, Chinese government still refuses to learn that these policies are further alienating Tibetans from the Chinese government. So, no matter what, you know, His Holiness always believed that we should have a conciliatory approach towards the Chinese government. And ever since first Tibetan delegation visited Tibetan areas in 1979, His Holiness, in consultation with the Tibetan leaders, have adopted a policy which is called a middle way approach to seek genuine autonomy for the Tibetan people and not to seek separation of Tibet from China. This policy is still, you know, firmly taken by the Tibetan people, but unfortunately, we have had number of contacts with the Chinese leaders over the past, nine, 10 years, but there have been no positive result. Chinese government still refuse to entertain the proposals that we have given to them. And we really do not know with the new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, who is expected by, you know, many people, especially in the Western communities, as well as within the Chinese community, that the new leader, Xi Jinping, might be able to review the whole situation in Tibet and bring about some positive changes to Tibetan policies. But so far, he haven't shown any kind of public willingness to bring about changes in Tibet. So, situation is really dismal in terms of the ground reality, also in terms of not having, engaged with the Chinese leaders in dialogue to resolve the issue of Tibet. But people inside Tibet are ever more very strong in their expressing, their views, particularly every time when Tibetan people set themselves on fire, the two slogans that they raise, one is the return of the Dalai Lama to Tibet, and second is the freedom for Tibetan people. So these demands are the aspirations of every single Tibetan individual. So we hope that the Chinese government will sooner or later try to appreciate the true aspirations of the Tibetan people. And we need your support, we need your prayers, and hope that despite the dismal situation, that His Holiness will be able to return to his rightful palace in Potala Palace, and that the Tibetan people will once again enjoy the total freedom that we used to enjoy before China invaded Tibet in 1949. So with these words, I end here. But as I said, if you have any questions, doubts, or suggestions, I would be very, very happy to exchange ideas. Thank you very much.
So we'll be taking questions now, and we're going to ask you to wait till you get to the mic before you ask your question.
Yes, can you tell us what is the most effective thing that we can do from here to support the Tibetan people and Tibetan freedom?
One of the most important things is letting your representatives here know that you care about Tibetan people. So once you do that, this helps us in we have many lobbying works in Washington, D.C., at the Capitol Hill, as well as at, you know, State Department. I think now over the past years, the relationship between China and United States have grown very much. And therefore, their bilateral relationship at every level has also increased tremendously. So, at every opportunity, we want the United States government and, politicians to take up Tibet issue. So this would be very, very helpful because, you know, one time I was told, even by one Chinese, that the Chinese government will listen only to one government, and that is the U.S. government. So which means even if one United States politician, you know, or a bureaucrat speak on Tibet, that really makes a difference. So obviously your voice may not reach effectively at the national level in Washington, D.C., but here at the local level to your representatives, senators, if you can at least, you know, make a phone call, write a personal letter, you know, expressing your support and concern over the situation in Tibet. And if you can do that with each, you know, self-immolation taking place. So this would really help us a lot.
That was the question I was going to ask. But there are a number of organizations that I get solicitations from, you know, once you get on the list. So one is the International Campaign for Tibet. One is the student organization. There are a couple of others. Is there one particular organization that you feel the money would be perhaps more well spent?
In terms of personal involvement, involving or engaging in one organization is okay. But what I was trying to suggest here is, you know, having one-on-one kind of contact with your own representative, that's much more effective rather than joining, 10,000 pool of people, you know, writing a signature and that's being sent to one office. I think there's a difference. So in terms of, supporting any political activities, in the United States to any organization, that really doesn't matter. We have International Campaign for Tibet, Students for Free Tibet, and there are non-political organizations also, in terms of preserving Tibetan culture, religion. So you can, in any capacity or in any way, you can support us.
It seems that there's a major change in the Chinese economy with the growth of the middle class. At the same time, it appears that there's an opening of information both in the United States and in China with information technology, WikiLeaks and such. Is there anything we can do information-wise, or can you predict how that might affect the Tibetan situation with the dynamic economics and information changes that are going on?
Maybe it's very difficult for a Tibetan issue to play a role in this very kind of huge issues, economics or information technology. But one thing I think important to understand is that from Tibetan's perspective, we always wanted any country to have good bilateral relationship with China, be it the United States or any country in the world. So what we fundamentally believe is that when you have better relationship with China, you hope to engage China in a better way. Once you are more trustworthy, then there's more room for you to makes China change into a better way. So that's one thing that we believe. And you might have also heard about this recent survey conducted by one organization called PEWPU. That survey I thought was pretty interesting. They have compared United States and China globally. Different countries in the world view China and the United States in different terms, in economy, in individual liberty, in soft power. Then you have different kind of perceptions from different countries. Even though globally it is said, the survey reported that United States is much preferred by the global community in 70% above, but there still are 50% of the survey who favors China too. So it's kind of pretty tricky, I thought, because even amongst those, over 36% believe that China, in China people enjoy civil liberties or human rights and fundamental freedoms. So China has been, over the number of years, have been trying to, shape, the world's perception, of China by, as you know, that they have been spending billions of dollars, media. They have been spending, millions of dollars in terms of helping developing countries in economic development. So this all efforts are to build a better image of China. So if they succeed in having a positive perception in the international community, the unfortunate thing is that China, in reality, is not good as, the 50% of the global community, perceive. There are lots of problems. There obviously are no fundamental, freedoms. And even when people, 36% of the people who believe that China, is enjoying human rights, is totally wrong from our perspective. It's perhaps, those are the people from countries, they also may not have this, political and civil rights. I always used to give example that China, at the United Nations Human Rights Council, they are a member of the Human Rights Council simply because, not to promote human rights of the international community, but simply because to protect their own wrongdoings. Because there are countries who always comes up with this argument by saying that, universal human rights is just a Western concept. That, the East has a different concept of looking at human rights and fundamental freedoms. So this country or these member states, they are always there in international forums to protect each other, their wrongdoings. And if their voices kind of, gets heard, then the problem would be, there will be continued, repression and oppression taking place in China and Tibetan areas. So, despite, what kind of, perception would be there for the Chinese, government, but in reality, we believe that if China opens up more, there'll be more opportunities for the Chinese people to understand. And one thing I also wanted to share is that over the past 4 or 5 years, since 2008, we have been making special efforts in reaching out to the Chinese community. We have been able to build understanding and trust amongst a number of Chinese, particularly those who are in Western countries. We have met with a number of Chinese scholars, dissidents, democrats, students, media people, you know, engaged them in different kinds of events. So from them, we try to understand that, you know, when they were in China, they have always believed that the Dalai Lama is really an evil person. But when they come out of China, and then when they hear different, you know, perspectives and opinions, then they realize that their own government is fooling them. Their own government is not providing them the true story. And as I said, since 2008, we have been, you know, the reason why we have reached out to the Chinese community is because in 2008, when the Chinese Olympic, you know, torch rally was disrupted in many parts of the world, especially by Tibet supporters and Tibetans, the Chinese government started this negative propaganda by saying that Tibetans are entire Chinese nation and entire Chinese people. And we have had instances of even those Chinese who have been sympathetic to Tibetan people who live in, United States, they have had a total change of perception against Tibetan people. And we, at that time, we really fear that, you know, this Chinese propaganda is really working. It's misleading the Chinese community. And therefore, we made that effort. Since making that effort, we have had over 1,000 Chinese, you know, writing different articles, Tibet-related articles, and almost all of them supportive of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan people initiative. They really come to understand that what Tibetan people are seeking is their right. It's not to kind of, you know, secede Tibet from China. So that's why we felt it's very important for us to build this trust and friendship and understanding. Ultimately, even when Tibet regains its freedom, the Chinese and Tibetans have to live side by side. And in present reality, we already have over 7.5 million Chinese settled in Tibetan areas. So we are just a minority, only 6 million Tibetans. So which means we cannot escape this reality, and it's better for the Tibetan people to build friendship and trust and to survive and live happily together.
Do you think the Chinese people as a community are somewhat moved by the protest and therefore are sympathetic to the Tibetan situation?
Many of them are. Many of them are really moved, not only in the recent series of self-immolation, but starting from 2008, there were widespread demonstrations that took place in entire Tibetan areas in Yuezhang, Ando, and Kham. I think the rough estimate was over 100 different kinds of protests took over in different city towns and cities in Tibet. So many young Chinese, even those who are in Beijing, because for the first time, they have come to know that Tibetans are protesting in Tibet. Even though at that time, the Chinese government was trying to project Tibetans as entire Chinese people, because one of the incident, a violent incident that took place in Lhasa, in the Chinese TV channels, they were shown that Tibetans were burning Chinese shops. And therefore, this footage was shown widely within China as well as in overseas Chinese communities. So the motive was to make Chinese people hate Tibetan people. But at the same time, there were many young Chinese people trying to digest why Tibetans are not happy in Tibet, why Tibetans hate Chinese people. So Now, I have also met in 2009 and 2010 young Chinese people, you know, telling me this very, dilemma that they had. And then they try to further research when they are here to understand what exactly is happening in Tibet. So gradually, you know, they have come to know that Tibetans indeed are very unhappy. It's not only those, among Chinese society who are interested in Tibetan politics or China politics. Now, very recently, I met with one Chinese business, young businessman, you know, who was introduced to me by one of my Chinese scholar friend, and he told me blankly that he is only interested in business and money. He said neither he likes the Chinese Communist Party, nor he likes the Tibetans, protesting. He has no interest. But then when we try to explain to him why Tibetans are protesting, what is our aspiration, what we demand, then he realized that it's all kind of makes sense to him. He said, he told me that I should be speaking this to his own small community. Let the Chinese community know that you are not seeking independence of Tibet. This is just a propaganda from Chinese communist leaders that Tibetans are, seeking independence. They are separating, working towards the disintegrity of China. So these are kind of negative, perceptions that they have been having for a long time. So once they understand the true, motivation of Tibetan people, they, definitely have sympathy and support for the Tibetan cause. And I also wanted to tell you that after 2008, Chinese lawyers organization based in Beijing, they conducted a survey in whole Tibetan area soon after 2008 protests. So it took them over 1 year to understand the situation in Tibet. And finally, they came up with a report, with a recommendation saying, that the Chinese government in Beijing should listen to the demands of the Tibetan people. So they 100% believe what Tibetan people are asking is legitimate.
Does travel to Tibet by Westerners help or hurt the cause?
In fact, we encourage Westerners to visit Tibet primarily for two reasons. One is to observe the true situation in Tibet. Even the Chinese leaders and Chinese officials always used to tell us that when we talk something about negative situation in Tibet, they always tell us, and even to a Westerner, by saying that, have you been to Tibet? If you say no, so why you are criticizing? You haven't seen, you haven't experienced the situation there. So which means if you observe the situation, if you experience the situation inside Tibet, then you always have some kind of authority to speak, what you have observed. That's one thing. And secondly, I think once you observe the situation, then, you just don't go as a tourist there, as a sightseeing, enjoy the, tradition, culture, and the Buddhist pilgrimage, but really try to understand the situation. Not necessarily, you should kind of, look into the political aspects, whether Tibetans are, having freedom to, express their opinion or not. This is something, obviously there is no freedom that every one of us know, but it's more kind of see if it's economic situation. Are Tibetans are there much opportunities for Tibetans to engage in businesses? Who owns the businesses, in small towns and cities? So how many Chinese are there? So this kind of, information when you come out of Tibet, this could be really helpful in terms of, you know, distributing or dispersing the, you know, true situation inside Tibet to other public in general. Or sometimes, as I, you know, initially said, when you can write a letter to your representative, then you have more kind of authority over this particular, you know, issue, and, you know, share this, you know, information to your representative to make him or her, you know, stand behind Tibet issue.
I have a question about, you mentioned the Tibetans who escape into India. What type of resources do they have, or do they have any to begin lives again until they feel like they can return, or is more help needed in that area as far as immediate attention goes to, I know it's a treacherous journey for them, and you know, I just had a question about how do they kind of set up their lives, and do they have help doing that, or is there more that we can do here to help them?
Thank you for asking this question. You know, when I was in Dharamsala, you know, we monitor the flow of Tibetan refugees from Tibet through Nepal to India. You know, it's not only for the political purpose of, you know, shaming the Chinese government in terms of, you know, look here, how many Tibetans are still fleeing, you know, out of Tibet with great risk, but also in terms of, you know, how, you know, should we help in terms of, you know, resettling them in an alien country. So, every year, in an average, 2,500 Tibetans escape from Tibet. And amongst them, there are monks and nuns, students, lay people, youths, different kinds of, you know, people. So, what the Central Tibetan Administration does is, you know, those people who are, you know, monks and nuns, they are sent into different monastic institutions. Those who are, you know, young in age, in their, let's say, from, you know, 16 till 30, they are sent into a temporary school. We call it a transit school, where they are, you know, taught basic English, Tibetan, maths, for about 3 to 5 years. And then for younger children, all are sent into different schools that we have in India. But this all takes place, you know, only, you know, after kind of making them all settle down, it is 4, 5, 6 months. So during this period, we again have a Tibetan refugee reception centers in Nepal as well as in Dharamsala. So the Central Tibetan Administration provides them food, clothing, lodging, etc., etc. And then there are Tibetan former political prisoners who have undergone, you know, imprisonments, you know, severe torture or this kind of thing. They are being again, you know, helped in providing counseling, because, you know, they do have different kinds of, you know, trauma, and then they are, you know, helped in you know, getting some kind of vocational training to, you know, restart their life. So there are many things that we have been doing. But without the help of international community, it's a huge task for the, you know, government in exile to perform. So your continued support is always welcome.
Up here, this will be our last question. just help me clarify a little bit in terms of the middle way approach that the Tibetans are asking for or seeking? What are some of the political and what are some of the demands that or what they're asking, both in political life and in spiritual, the life of spiritual practice, that they would like from the Chinese?
Thank you. The middle way policy, or the middle, you know, the approach is what we see. Middle way itself, it's a, you know, it's, I think, derived from Buddhist philosophy, I believe, Madhyamaka. So what that means is we try to avoid the two extremes. One is the present, you know, condition, which is very acute. The second is the complete independent sovereign nation of Tibet. So we wanted to find a middle way. This could you know, benefit both the peoples, the Tibetans as well as Chinese. So that would mean genuine and meaningful autonomy for the Tibetan people. When we meant Tibetan people, it's the entire three regions, or the all Tibetan areas, including the Tibet Autonomous Region and other Tibetan areas that are incorporated into different Chinese prefectures. So, what we demand is that, you know, the defense can be taken care of by the Chinese government, the central government, and the foreign relations can be taken care of by the central government, and the rest of the authorities, particularly the administration, and including, you know, health, education, you know, religion, even economy, policing. So all this that has nothing to do with foreign relations or the defense of a country should be given to the Tibetan people. That's you know, and the very purpose of asking this is to ensure that the Tibetan cultural identity is protected and preserved over the long years. But unfortunately, you know, the Chinese government still today, you know, believes that, you know, our ask is nothing but a disguise, you know, the term is as a disguised form of independence. So which means even though we are talking about autonomy, the Tibetan people are asking independence of Tibet. So that's the difficult part for them to convince that, you know, we have no, you know, hidden agendas here. When we ask for autonomy, we meant autonomy. But still today, you know, in order to simply, you know, delay, or rather to kind of, you know, hold this very discussion, the Chinese government always say that, first of all, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has to acknowledge that Tibet has been an alienable part of China, you know, since ancient times. But His Holiness has made it, stated many times that, you know, he has no authority to rewrite Tibet history. You know, and also he being a monk, he cannot tell lie. So you know, His Holiness always said that, you know, it's not up to the politicians to discuss about past history. Let the historians, independent historians, you know, talk about what Tibet had been in the past. So why we bring up this, you know, issue simply to kind of, you know, have more obstacles in negotiating of a future Tibet where we are willing to accept the sovereignty of China, where we are willing to protect the territorial integrity of China. But unfortunately, as I said, you know, there doesn't seem to have any common sense on the part of Chinese leaders.
So, on the behalf of all my friends from the center, I would like to express my sincere gratitude for Mr. Lofsang Dalal, representative of the His Holiness Dalai Lama in North America, so accepting our request to educate us about Tibetan issues. I very, very appreciate it. Thank you very much. And also I'd like to thank all my friends here for your support and for your interest in Tibetan cause. Thank you very much, and please continue to do so. Thank you. And have a wonderful night. Yeah.
And we'd like to invite you and your family to join Geshe and Geshe Sampo for refreshments. And everyone else, we're having refreshments out in the lobby also, so please stay around. And thank you for coming.